This week's Science Slot is another in our series on the grey areas that exist between science fact and fiction. It's a night's collaboration with the McDermott Institute, and this evening's flight of fancy is the mineral unobtainium. Most recently, it was a plot device in the movie Avatar, although it's had other outings in science fiction pop culture. In Avatar, unobtainium is the reason that humans are causing so much trouble with the Na'vi on the moon of Pandora. I should remember that. The other day, Brian tracked down McDermott Institute co-director and Auckland University Associate Physics Professor Nicola Gaston just before she headed off into the Scottish Highlands for a hike. Nicola is interested in the parallels between the fictional unobtainium and Avatar and the theoretical possibilities of solid hydrogen. Here's Sigourney Weaver to set the scene.
But there is beauty even in the most frightening things. In a dreamlike landscape, reminiscent of a Magritte painting, vast magnetic fields, coupled with the exotic properties of unobtainium, allow the Hallelujah Mountains to float in flux, constantly moving. As the most efficient superconductor known to exist, unobtainium is a rare earth mineral, mined by humans, and the sole reason for their presence on Pandora.
It's a superconductor that exists at room temperature, right?
That's the unobtainium that is a big plot point on the movie Avatar, Brian, which I'm guessing you probably saw a few years ago when it came out.
No, I didn't, but I saw it recently because my son was watching it.
Aha, right. And so the name unobtainium is quite, I don't know, it's a bit of a joke in a way.
It's a bit clumsy.
It's a bit clumsy. It's not that easy to say.
Unobtainium.
And it does sort of have a longer history than in the movie Avatar, so it's sort of been used in fiction to mean a thing that we're struggling to obtain.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
But the version in Avatar is this room temperature superconductor for the very simple reason that that's something that we understand would be a wonderful material that would create a paradigm shift in our ways of using energy. And so in Avatar, there's what people might remember visually if they've seen it is these floating islands on the planet which float because superconductors can float on magnetic fields. So that's sort of one of the premises of the whole movie is that the reason people are there to begin with is to extract this incredibly valuable element called unobtainium.
It's going to make them all rich, and if somebody gets in the way, too bad. And their trees.
Yeah, so if we're fact-checking this particular story, Brian, the very sad thing is that that part of it's very true, of course, because we have this very long history of being colonialist and going from one place to another to extract natural resources for economic benefit, right? And so there is something about the concept of unobtainium that is, unfortunately truer than we would like it to be.
Just remind us of a superconductor, what a superconductor is, and why it would be so marvellous if a superconductor could exist on this table in front of me right now at room temperature.
Well, a superconductor conducts electricity without wasting any of the energy. That's the very simplest version of it. Most metals that conduct electricity will have electrons move around, but those electrons will bump into each other, to the atoms in the lattice that they're moving through, and that's what we call resistance. It's basically the production of heat. So it's waste energy that you would want to be transmitting through your material being converted into heat and being wasted. And the nice thing about superconductors is that they don't do that because instead of having the electrons moving through the lattice individually, they couple up and they move through in a very coordinated way so that they don't bump into other things and create all that waste heat.
Even something like copper wire is not a superconductor, nowhere near it.
No, regular copper wire is a very good conductor, but it's not a superconductor. It's really quite a different phenomenon, and one that on Earth we only know of as existing at very low temperatures. So if you cool materials down, And a lot of metals will do this behavior at very, very low temperatures. So I think mercury was the first one that was found to behave like this. You cool it right down and you realize that instead of having this this characteristic resistance, which where the electrons bump into each other and waste heat, you instead have loss of resistance at a characteristic temperature.
Why does this happen at a very low temperature?
Well, because in a simple way, at high temperature, you've got a lot of energy associated with each of the electrons, and so they're going to not want to move in this coordinated fashion. So, you know, the lower temperature you get to, the more calm everything is inside the material, and so the more possible it is for this behaviour to happen.
Problem is, the temperatures you're talking about are really, really cold, aren't they? 100 or 200 degrees minus Celsius.
They are for most regular superconductors. And then in sort of the last 50 years, there's been this whole field of high-temperature superconductors. But that's still many degrees below zero. But high-temperature superconductors are a thing. They're being explored and used for technological purposes. But they still require cooling. They still require cooling below zero, just not as far as the original superconductors, which is why they're called high-temperature superconductors.
What do we use them for at the moment, if indeed we do use them?
We do use them for a bunch of different things, and they're all sort of energy-related, but often actually one of the biggest uses is in magnets. So I mentioned these islands on Avatar that float about, and that's because there's this connection between electricity and magnetism. So if you have electrons and they move around, you have electricity. But then once they're moving around, that creates a current and that creates a magnetic field. And so these two things go together. So when you have a current that is very efficient, such as you can create with superconducting wire, then you can create a very good electromagnet, basically. So those kinds of applications, I think, I'm not an expert in the engineering of any of this, but I think perhaps the pragmatic thing is that if you're not moving something around, then the cost of cooling it to the point that the superconductivity can exist is relatively easy to do. So those are the kinds of applications where superconductivity is used. But the idea of replacing all our wires everywhere with superconductors is effectively not possible, just because that would require cooling everything everywhere. And so we can't really do that with these superconductors that require cooling, even the ones that are called high-temperature superconductors.
So one of the things that we're looking for in this series is where something like unobtainium, this room-temperature superconductor, might exist. And here the link is to something which is all around us, but not in the form we know it has, and I'm talking about hydrogen.
Yes, so this is really funny, Brian, because I think the idea of unobtainium is that this we're always going to find new elements if we keep searching. And actually, we've known for a wee while now that the periodic table is basically finite. We've pretty much gotten to the practical end of it for our purposes, and we might find some more stable elements or isotopes of heavy elements if we keep looking. You know, they might exist on other planets, but they're still pretty much going to be limited by the same limitations in nuclear stability, and so they're not really going to be useful for anything. So this idea that we're actually going to go to any other planet and find a material that suddenly magically has these properties is basically not true. And in some ways that's a good thing, because I think it helps us get past this colonial idea of just going out and finding stuff, and it actually helps us understand what material science does best, which is reconfigure and repurpose materials that we already have. So something like hydrogen, which is, you know, the most abundant element we have, we've got an awful lot of it, actually has the ability to behave in amazingly different ways depending on the circumstances that you put it in, depending on whether it's in different molecules, depending on temperature, depending on the pressure you put it under. And so one of the reasons I thought of talking about this topic is that just this last week, there's been a study that's just come out in Nature where they're actually very cautious about the way they word this. They claim to have found that the probable transition to the metallic state in hydrogen at 4 million atmospheres, so very, very, very high pressures compared to what we have on Earth. But if you squeeze hydrogen that much together, you can convert it to a metal. And that has been sort of postulated or understood to probably be going to happen for a long time. But one of the things about observing the transition of hydrogen to a metal is that in 1968, a New Zealander, actually Neil Ashcroft, predicted that metallic hydrogen would have a transition to superconductivity that would be around room temperature. So if you can make metallic hydrogen under lots and lots and lots and lots of pressure, of course, then you have something which could be a room temperature superconductor, which would be very cool.
And don't you need 400 atmospheres equivalent to one atmosphere of Earth in order to do that? And how would you do that and keep the room at room temperature?
Well, in reality, the way they do the experiments is with a very, very, very small sample of hydrogen. And they create what's called a diamond anvil cell, and then they squeeze it together. So they really just like lean on it very hard to squish it all together. And the reason I think this is an interesting story is that it's kind of a story of failure, because people have been trying to do this for years and years and years. And you can look up the Wikipedia page for metallic hydrogen has a decent sort of summary of some of the dates. People have been trying to make this for years and years and years using different experimental techniques. And they squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and they claimed they'd made metallic hydrogen. And then they lost the sample in 2017 to say, oh, we can't reproduce our results. And so everybody was quite sceptical. And so that's part of why I think it's a little bit funny that this current study has come out with people being quite cautious about only claiming that probably they've seen metallic hydrogen. But what they've actually done is redesign the cell that they squeeze the hydrogen in to have a new kind of geometry, and that's supposed to help it be stable up to the very high pressures. Because, of course, if you're squeezing whatever your cell is, and they actually make it with diamond on the inside because that's so hard, that helps you get the right pressures that you need. But, of course, if you're squeezing anything hard enough, you can risk breaking it, which is why these experiments have been so hard to get right.
Doesn't it take a huge amount of energy to put that kind of pressure on the hydrogen gas to turn it into a solid metal?
It takes a large amount of energy for the quantity of hydrogen, I guess. That's probably right. But they work with very small amounts in order to achieve these pressures. And so, yes, the sad thing is that probably making large quantities of metallic hydrogen is not going to be something that we do on Earth. But one of the reasons that people have been interested in this in other situations is the idea that you might actually have hydrogen, because it's so abundant, it will exist in large quantities on other planets. And some of those planets have much higher pressures, certainly at the core of the planet, than just on the surface and the atmosphere.
I'm thinking of Jupiter. Isn't Jupiter mostly hydrogen gas?
Well, yes, there's a lot of hydrogen gas on many, many planets. So there is this idea that hydrogen, compressed hydrogen, does exist on some of these planets under pressure, and some planets may have enough pressure to have the hydrogen already existing in the metallic form. And so if we can understand the properties of it on Earth, then we can also understand what's going on some of these planets.
Has it behaved as a superconductor?
No, so they couldn't get that far with this particular experiment, just getting the signature of it turning to a metal, to conducting, was, you know, a sufficient breakthrough for them to publish that result. But essentially, the very last line of the paper is that, of course, the next thing they are going to do is set up some spectroscopic measurements so that they can observe the superconductivity. So that's the next thing they're trying to do. We'll see how long it takes them to do it now that they've got the first sample made. But that's how science works. It might happen quickly. It might take a while.
And how do you keep it a solid?
I think they just keep the pressure on. As long as you've got it held at the same pressure, then it will stay in the same state.
And to do that, I assume you need to have a pretty solid kind of receptacle to hold it in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's not going to hang around in a glass jar with the lid on.
No, it's very much not. So it's in this very specific contraption that has been designed purely for the purpose of compressing hydrogen into a solid and then into a metallic form and then holding it there.
What would happen to this solid hydrogen if it was released to the air at room temperature?
It would pretty immediately revert to a gaseous form. I guess what you're asking is how violent that would be, and I don't.
Well, it's one of the things I'm asking. I wasn't entirely thinking about the violent possibilities, though.
Well, it's one of the things that's it's worth mentioning, I think, in this conversation, because of course hydrogen is relevant to energy technologies in a whole lot of different contexts, which is just that hydrogen on its own is a good fuel. It will combust. It burns very happily with oxygen. So I'm imagining, and I'm just thinking out loud here, that if you were to open up the solid sample in a regular room, you've got a very high concentration of hydrogen in one spot in the room because it's been squished into a solid. And so I can imagine it might react with any oxygen in the air. And so you might get something exciting happening if you did that too quickly.
If we were able to produce quantities of solid hydrogen, what would we use it for?
That's a good question, because not everything that we use electricity for is necessarily a good candidate for changing to a room temperature superconductor. I mean, the question really comes down to economics in some ways. You know, if we could produce a room temperature superconductor as cheaply as we can produce copper wire, then that would be one scenario which would be very different from anything that is actually going to be plausible. I think one of the things that we're learning actually in material science is that you do need different forms of a material or different ways of using it for different contexts. And actually I was in a recent conversation with some people who do a lot of work on hydrogen, but around the fuel science of it. And so whether that's burning hydrogen directly as a fuel or using hydrogen in a fuel cell to create electricity, which is the other way you can react hydrogen instead of reacting it with oxygen and air, you can react it effectively with electrons to break up the molecule. And both of these things create energy, and both of them we can use. And so you have hydrogen fuel cell cars, or you can have cars that run on hydrogen as a fuel that you burn directly. And those two cases, just as much as using hydrogen as a superconductor, it's always going to be horses for courses in a way. None of these things is better for everything. They all have their costs, but they're all possible and they can all be explored in different applications.
Assuming that there is solid metallic hydrogen in the core of some of the gas giants where there might be this 400 Earth atmosphere pressure going down, once we tried to mine it, even if we could, wouldn't it lose its pressure and then lose that solid property, that superconducting property anyway?
If we could access it, you mean? That would.
Yes, assuming we could actually get into a gas giant and access the solid hydrogen, which is quite a big if.
That's a big thought experiment. Yeah, so I guess one thing I will say is it's 4 million atmospheres, I think, not 400.
Okay, right.
So it's, yeah,
4 million, did I say 400?
But yes, it's a really, really high pressure. There's really no sensible prospect of us even mining this stuff to do something with it. And I think that's actually a good thing. It helps us change how we think about materials. It helps us think about how we use resources. Material science is very much now about rethinking those sorts of problems, about repurposing materials, about learning to be sustainable about how we use them. There's a whole, you know, series of conversations which you've probably seen around things like lithium in batteries and how we start to do this stuff better. And so actually some of these big picture questions, such as around metallic or superconducting hydrogen, are more about how do we learn from what does exist, what can exist, and what we can make. So one suggestion has been that anything that's hydrogen rich under pressure might have some ability to be a room temperature superconductor. So hydrogen rich molecules like silane have been studied now for the same sorts of purposes. So we can be much smarter about combining elements and doing it in ways that we can control and that allow us to reuse things that we already have access to, rather than trying to go out and explore and steal things from other planets.
Isn't water hydrogen rich? I'm drinking some right now, actually.
For example?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want to produce hydrogen, you can if you've got enough electricity, you can extract hydrogen from water, store it as H2, and then you could put that as a fuel tank on a car and burn the hydrogen, which just means reconverting it back to water. So that's one of the reasons that people like the idea of hydrogen as a fuel so much. It effectively can be taken out of water, and you can also just burn it again, creating nothing but water, which is kind of like, I don't know, you can say many things about water, but I think it's probably still one of the least polluting substances we can think of, right?
But we're not doing that yet, are we?
We're not doing that in a serious way, but we are looking at the technologies required to use hydrogen as a fuel, to burn it directly. And, you know, a big part of that is that it's a very simple reaction. The only issue that we have is how much energy it costs to create the hydrogen fuel in the first place. So that's an energy cost, and that has to be economic in order for us to start using hydrogen as a fuel more generally. But it is something that a lot of people are thinking more and more about, because it's a naturally carbon-free fuel. You know, it has many attractive things about it if we can source the fuel in the right way, which means in a carbon-free way, in a green way. But that is something that a lot of people are thinking about. So it's actually much, much, much closer to reality than the idea of the superconductor unobtainium that we started with.
Nicola, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's a real pleasure, Brian.
From the McDermott Institute, that is co-director and Auckland University Associate Physics Professor Nicola Gaston, talking with Brian about the parallels between the fictional mineral in the movie Avatar, that's unobtainium, and the theoretical properties of solid hydrogen.